you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and my pal Michael Lane is back. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back to the show. Now, of course, when you were on the show the last time, we talked about a Shazam comic, and so this time we're here to talk about a Shazam comic. Because, I mean, obviously, by the time you're all hearing this, the day it comes out, the Shazam movie is now out in theaters, which is, who would have ever expected that? I mean, that's a movie that has been gestating for years, and I honestly never thought they would do it. But now it's here, it's in theaters, and you can go to the theater and see Shazam. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I know other people have said this, but it is still bizarre to me that within the same month or two period, not only are we finally getting a Shazam picture, but Marvel had their Captain Marvel movie come out at the same time.
Isn't that amazing?
Statistically, the odds after all 50 years of name battling between the characters and the companies that they would manage to land so close together on the big screen too.
Yeah, I'm really, of course, obviously, the movie has not come out by the time Michael and I are recording this, but I'm really excited to see it. We'll talk about it at the end of the show, kind of our thoughts of what we think about the movie, or at least what we've seen up to this point. But we're here, for this episode, to talk about Limited Collector's Edition number C27, Shazam. And this is one of the three Shazam-dedicated limited collector's editions that were put out. There were others, of course, as I said, Michael and I talked about the famous first edition Wiz Comics, and then there was a Superman Shazam team-up book back when the Treasury changed his name to All New Collector's Edition. So Shazam got pretty heavy representation in the Treasuries, and that was because, obviously, this wasn't too long after DC bought the rights to the character from Foss, along with all the other characters, and they wanted to make a splash. I mean, they wanted to really make this a big deal. I mean, this is just before, and then, I mean, obviously, they must have known the TV series from Filmation was in the offing, so they knew they had a big, you know, kind of a big property that they wanted to showcase. And so this is the second of three of those collections. And so the cover is, I think, one of the greatest Treasury covers ever done. It's supposedly by Bob Oxner, who, if it is, he's managing to really do a great pastiche of kind of that Pete Costanza, C.C. Beck style, because I had no idea it was Oxner until I looked it up online, and apparently in an interview on the Comics Reader in the 70s, he said, yeah, I did it. But I love this cover, the shot of Captain Marvel arm-in-arm with Billy Batson, and then you've got this blue sky with this just simple white circle behind them. I think it's like, to me, one of the great poster images of this character. What do you think of it, Michael?
Oh, it's superb. And I have to admit, I have thought all this time that this was an Otto Bender image. Maybe Kurt Schaffenberger, if I looked at Billy, because Billy is a little, with the hair, is a little more Kurt Schaffenberger like. Yeah. But until I looked up the background for this episode, I had no idea that Bob how do you say his last name again?
Oxner, as far as I know.
Yeah, I had no idea he did the image. And I should mention, you had asked me before we did this which Treasury would be interested. Yeah, I'd be interested in covering. And I honestly couldn't make up my mind because each one had certain stories I really loved. One or two, you know, not so much. And finally, I showed all three of them to my 9-year-old, and I said, which one do you think we should talk about? And she pointed to this one, and I'm certain it's because of the blue background over this full image that she just found this cover to be the one that jumped out at her, understandably.
Yes, it's so simple, so iconic. The colors are like, you know, the 100% saturation of the reds and the blues and the yellows and the whites. I mean, it's just a beautiful, simple image. The logo is great, though, with one magic word, Shazam, the original Captain Marvel. A little bit of a dig there at Marvel. but, I mean, and I can see why your kid would love it, because it's just eye candy. It's so, so beautiful. So this collection features 8 stories plus some bonus features, which we will, of course, get to as well. So I'm only going to do very, very brief synopses simply because there are so many stories here that if we got bogged down in the details, we'd be here all day. So on the inside cover, there's the table of contents, and there's a little shot of Captain Marvel standing there. So the first story is called Savannah's Voodoo Curse by Otto Binder and Pete Costanza. It's from Captain Marvel Adventures number 127. Using a piece of Captain Marvel's cape, Savannah creates a voodoo doll of his arch nemesis and uses it to take control of Captain Marvel. So there. That's the thing. I mean, obviously there's a lot more to it, but that's the essential setup of this story. So, Michael, what do you think of this first one?
I love it. It is so perfect as an example of Otto Binder as a writer and the charming but goofy nature of everything that goes on in the story. And it's got one of my favorite splash pages here, which has got this wonderful image of Savannah and Cap looking at each other, and he's telling him to say, "I am a big stupid cheese," and Captain Marvel looks back and goes, you are a big stupid cheese. And it's goofy childish humor, but you know, these comics were clearly intended for young kids at the time, and so the humor is not terribly mature, but Otto Binder just writes such a charming story. And the way he writes Savannah in particular is just, he's so evil, but he's also just so goofy and kind of incompetent at the same time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's like everything just keeps going wrong for him typically in these stories, but he just never gives up. And I love the way he draws him. He's so creepy and just this kind of mad scientist, you know, design. But the way he draws his face, you just can picture this little tiny madman, and it's just a great look. I love him. And go ahead.
I'm glad you mentioned that he's kind of like hapless, because my favorite detail in this story is when Savannah escapes jail and goes back to his lab and all the lights get turned off because he forgot to pay the electric bill. That is a supervillain thwarted by the electric company is just fantastic.
There have been quite a few times where, you know, the various Marvel family members get saved just by sheer luck, and this is one of those. And I like the end when he's in the jail cell and he's got his little former dolls that he was using, his voodoo dolls, and he's just completely gone insane and is just rambling. And it jumped out at me too, because there's this image of Batman in the Golden Age that always gets shuffled around online, and I think he's talking to Catwoman and he says something like, "Papa Spank."
Yeah, yeah.
And this is such an odd thing for Batman, but he says the same thing with the story, and I was just like, was that a thing back then? I don't know. It's an odd term, but, you know, so it just reminded me of that Batman image that's always floating around.
Yeah, I wondered that myself. I was like, that must have been a thing, because, yeah, he's sitting at the end when Captain Marvel's captured Savannah and put him back in jail, and he's just sitting on the floor playing with his toys, and he's like, you know, and Captain Marvel's like, "Are those voodoo dolls?" And he says, "No, those are just ordinary dolls." He's just playing with them. "Now be nice or Papa Spank, And it just ends with, like, what the artwork by Pete Costanza is absolutely wonderful. I mean, I just love, first of all, there's a lot of panels on every page. I mean, this is a pretty packed story, but yet everything looks really clear and simple. I mean, you could see why Captain Marvel, I think, eventually ended up outselling even Superman, because these stories are just so direct and so pure. And I love on that final page of, even though you've got 6 other panels going on, you still have room for that kind of bigger image where Marvel smashes through the window and punches Savannah. I just love all that. And I love the idea that, of course, Captain Marvel must be reserving his strength, because if he punched Savannah with his normal strength, he would knock Savannah's head off. But he does it just enough to knock him off his feet.
Yeah, people see how Captain Marvel looked, and he was sort of designed by C.C. Beck, and they assume a lot of the art was simplistic, and it is in a way. But like you said, if you look at these panels, like that scene of him crashing through the lab, there's a ton of detail there, and there's a lot of glass flying everywhere. You see the volcano earlier in the story that Captain Marvel flies into. The style and design are simplistic, but the art itself is not simple, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, it's very, well, I said it's not in the same style, but it's a little Alex Toth-like in that he knew just how much detail you could put in to really convey these images. And said the storytelling is crystal clear, again, for a story where a lot of stuff happens. It works really well, and I really like seeing it actually this bigger size, which is nice.
Yeah, so this is just a really good example of a classic, fun, entertaining Golden Age Captain Marvel story. Just the reason this is one of my favorite Golden Age characters.
Yeah, and you said, as I mentioned, this is from Captain Marvel Avengers number 127. So, I mean, by this point, they had done probably several hundred Captain Marvel stories. And yet, you know, this still feels really a lot of fun. I mean, you know, they obviously were not running on fumes at this point. They were still kind of running full tilt, and that's kind of amazing considering how many stories they've already had to have done by this point. So it's a good one to lead off with because it's Captain Marvel versus Savannah. You know, it's like your main hero and your main protagonist. So it's a really, really solid story. So the next story is Captain Marvel Jr. From Captain Marvel Jr. number 54, The Man with 100 Heads by Otto Binder and Bud Thompson, and it features this startling image of Captain Marvel punching a guy and just knocking his head completely off. And then it comes with this bonus thing, and I don't know whether this page came with the Treasury specifically or came in the original comic, but it actually is like an activity page where you can take – it tells kids you can take the splash page and cut a slit in it and then run this strip of different heads through the slit so you can watch the heads change, which, of course, you know, you're not supposed to do because it's going to ruin your comic book. But I have no idea whether this is something DC stuck in or whether this is in the original story.
My guess would be it was not in the original. I didn't go back and check because I know – I did see credit one point about E. Nelson Bridwell and Bob Oxenor both being credited as doing some of the additional material here. I don't know if this is one of them. My guess would be that it probably is, but – that's one of the nice things about all the Shazam treasuries, and I know they're not the only treasuries this happened in, but more than most, they were really good at putting in little games and stuff and activities for the kids, from coloring stuff, other stuff. You'll mention as we go along in this, I'm sure. But they did that better than I think any of the other treasuries did.
Yeah, it's a fun little detail, and like I said, this is the kind of stuff I would have done when I was younger, but luckily I've gotten older not to mangle my treasuries. So this story is about Captain Marvel Jr. tries to capture an armed robber who manages to commit numerous stick-ups but can never be identified thanks to his ability to change heads. This is a weird story because the whole notion of this guy that can change his head is just kind of glossed over. Like, he just able to do it through the – like – you know what I mean? Like, it's almost kind of got like a Dick Tracy sort of feel to it. And the artwork, I think I maybe didn't mention, by Bud Thompson, reminds me a little bit of Chester Gould in terms of the visuals. So, I mean, I don't know. We're like, I don't know if all the Captain Marvel Jr. stories were this strange, but it just tonally seemed very weird to me.
This is another one written by Bender. And he really had a knack for coming up with some bizarre premises in his story. And this is definitely out there. And they did explain it. You know, he had an accident. And they basically transplanted his brain,
right,
and apparently his whole face into his torso. So, and then he has all these fake heads he wears to commit crimes. Of course, he's dressed, so I don't know how he can see through the eyes that apparently is in his chest, I guess, but he does it. But yeah, I say that because they remind me of them, but all the heads he uses it jumped out at me too. They all look like Dick Tracy villains of some kind.
Yeah.
So there was definitely some kind of influence going on there in this story. But that first panel where he punches him and the guy's head just flies right off and Captain Marvel Jr. screams, holy moly, that just made me chuckle because it was just so bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. And later on, the guy puts Captain Marvel – put Freddie Freeman, I should say, in a guillotine, and he manages to get rid – just as the blade is about to come down and cut his own head off, he turns into Captain Marvel and he catches the blade in his teeth, which he then breaks off because he's got super strength. So again, it's very weird. Like, I just tonally, I was like, wow, this one is just kind of out there. So I enjoyed it, but it was like, okay, I guess they were, you know, they needed to differentiate between these characters. Mm-hmm. Captain Marvel Jr., as I mentioned, this is from number 54. He had his own book. So then they had to have some way to make them. And it feels a little more, I don't want to say adult, because it's not adult, but it's just not as sort of kid friendly as, like, say, the previous story that we just talked about.
Yeah, these can get dark at times, and this isn't particularly an example of that, but you're right, the tone is different. But it could be pretty uneven in the Captain Marvel books, because you would go from something very whimsical to very violent. Like, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but there's a panel, another one that floats around online, where basically someone throws a bag full of human heads at Captain Marvel, and he's just like, oh my God, holy moly, and there's all the – and it really is in the story. I don't want to waste time getting into it, but it is actually a bag of human heads that someone is throwing at Captain Marvel. Yeah. So they could do that and just startle you with how kind of bizarre it could get. One thing that did – you know, I enjoyed this story, and I think Bud Thompson's art was better when he did the faces of the ones with the Chester Gold influence. But the rest of the art in the story, I think this was the one example where the larger treasury size format didn't necessarily help the art. Mm-hmm. It kind of showed some of the characters are stiffer, the way they're posed and stuff. And it's not bad. I think he's a perfectly good artist. But I think reading this in the smaller size, it would look a little better. This is one of those rare examples where the Treasury isn't that kind to it.
I can see that. There's very little detail in the backgrounds, like a lot of just sort of flat colors and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's fine. It's nothing great. Again, the premise is what's interesting. Following the story, there's a pinup, a Captain Marvel Jr. pinup flying with a giant eagle. It's uncredited, so I don't know who did it. I know that Mac Rayboy did a lot of the Captain Marvel covers, which are very, very iconic. I don't think this is his work necessarily, but I can't exactly tell.
It actually is because it was taken from a cover.
Okay.
Master Comics issue 32, that same image is on there. And it's interesting because he's an amazing artist. His cover is stunning. But he does have a tendency, and Eric Larson was talking about this on Twitter about a month or two ago. Macroboy, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, liked more than most artists then to copy or cut and paste images from prior pages and work and reuse them over and over again.
Okay.
So this pose, if you read a couple Macroboy issues, drawn stories with Captain Marvel Jr., you will see this pose pop up at least half a dozen times.
Exactly. Oh, wow.
This image. It's a beautiful image, but he reused this so many times. And it's one of those things, if you read three or four Macroboy stories, you'll see several poses and images kind of coming up repeatedly. And, you know, one page he'll be flying up, the next page he'll be flying down. But it's exactly the same image that's just keeps getting used. And I don't fault him. I mean, it's commercial art. The guy had
got to get it done, yeah.
And they were pumping out tons of Captain Marvel. I mean, he was a very popular character. Elvis Presley's favorite one, apparently.
That's right. That's right.
So I don't blame him again, but he did. He was notorious for that.
I'm glad you mentioned the Elvis thing because it's sort of funny how where you get, like, life imitates art and then art imitates life and that – Captain Marvel Jr.'s general look was Elvis. It was his favorite comic book, Captain Marvel Jr. And so Elvis's later look in the 70s with the little side cape and the flare, like, and the piping was influenced by the look of Captain Marvel Jr. And then later on after that, when Kingdom Come came around, Alex Ross designed the new Captain Marvel Jr. on Elvis. He kind of looks like Elvis. So it was just sort of worked its time as a flat circle, and it worked its way back. So the next story is Shazam and Mr. Tawny's Diet Dangers from Captain Marvel Adventures number 121 by Otto Bender and C.C. Beck. Captain Marvel helps his friend, the lion-human hybrid Mr. Talkie Tawny, lose weight after the Tiger Man notices he's got too heavy. The only problem is a gangster who uses hypnotism to keep Tawny fat. So I'm not an expert at these characters. I mean, I know generally, but like where is the idea? Where did the Talkie Tawny idea come from? The idea just to have a Tiger Man that just talks like a human and wears pajamas and stuff like. Do you have any idea what the impetus for this was?
I don't know what his inspiration was, but I do have to say Tawny is one of my absolute favorite characters from the Marvel Family books. I love Talkie Tawny because, again, he's just a talking tiger who just hangs out with them and everyone accepts him. And one of the best aspects of him is when he first appears, there's no origin. He's just a talking tiger from India who just decides to travel to Fawcett City. When he gets there, everyone, of course, freaks out and he's like, unintentionally terrorizing the whole town because it's a talking tiger. But Captain Marvel, you know, wisdom of Solomon, he figures out that Tawny's a good guy, so he gets him a job as a tour guide at the zoo, I think, and everyone comes to love him. But they don't even bother to explain where the heck did this talking tiger come from. It's not until his second appearance that they bother to give him an origin, and you find out that some old coot gave him a serum that basically gave him the ability to talk and evolved into where he was walking upright. But I just love that they decide to introduce a talking tiger, and there's no attempt whatsoever to give any explanation, and everyone's just, like, on board with the whole idea.
Let's just roll with it, yeah. The artwork by C.C. Beck is, as you might imagine, is terrific. I love his use of silhouettes and heavy blacks, especially on page 7 of the story where we find out that this crook that wants to keep Tawny fat for his own selfish reasons, he's been hypnotizing Tawny in the middle of the night and feeding him all this food. And so he's eating in the middle of the night, and that's what he seems to keep – he's exercising. Captain Marvel puts him on an exercise regimen, but he keeps gaining weight, and nobody can figure out why. It's because this guy's feeding him all this food. But there's this great panel of the crook in the foreground, and he's all in silhouette holding up a tray of food, and the aroma is drifting in front of Talkie, and he's all like – and then the next panel, you've got – it's reversed, where you've got Talkie Tawny in the foreground slurping away at a giant, like a whole turkey or a whole chicken, and there's like a pineapple and some other stuff. And then the crook is in the background in silhouette. And then the very next panel after that, the Captain Marvel flicks the lights on, and he sees the guy gets revealed. But the wall that the light switches on is like a heavy dark. And it's just, it's really great staging. And again, not surprising. C.C. Beck knew what he was doing. He was a great artist. But I just, these are, this is another one where I think the Treasure Size does it some good, because I really think it really mm-hmm. it highlights the crispness of this work.
Absolutely. And poor Tawny, though. He gets fat shamed so much in this story.
He does.
You couldn't get away with this now without people writing the letters and just saying, you know, being defensive about the idea, but they really pick on him. And this, my favorite page is the one where Captain Marvel's trying to help him exercise. And he's one panel, he's massaging him rather brutally. And then they're sparring. And then the last panel, he's literally just tossing Tawny around, slamming him on the ground. And I'm like, with his strength, Tawny should literally be pummeled into oblivion by the time he gets to that last page. And the poor guy just suffers so much. And the whole premise is that they're going to drop 25 pounds in 1 week.
Right. Dangerously unsafe.
Yes, incredibly. And especially by the time you get to it, they really do it in like 2 days based on this villain's plan. But so I was feeling pretty awful for poor Tawny during this whole story.
I also love the detail on that page you just mentioned that Captain Marvel takes his cape off to do this work. I just think it's a fun detail. It's sort of like, all right, let's relax a little. I'll stand here in my leotard, but I'm taking the cape off. I think like that's just like a fun little detail. So the next feature is a Color the Shazam Family one-page pinup where it's got a shot of Captain Marvel holding a family portrait, which is in black and white, and that it's meant for you kids to color. And it features all the members of the Marvel family. And when I say all, I mean even some that probably shouldn't be there. Yes. Michael, do you want to explain that?
This is always bothered me that this was here, because this is another image they took from a cover. I can't remember which issue was, but it's an issue, I think, of Wiz Comics. If I'm wrong, it could be Captain Marvel, but it was definitely on a cover. And if you look at the cover, you can see it in color, and this is a little more obvious there. But it includes the unfortunate character of Steamboat, who is a black character, which unfortunately is drawn in an incredibly offensive racial stereotype manner. And I just kind of feel like, given it's the 1970s at this point, I kind of wish they had kind of removed him from the image. Yeah. They kind of did try to cover him with the curtain there a little bit, but – and it's black and white, so you could flip by it and not catch him.
Until you mentioned it. I literally never saw this, and then you asked me about it, and I was like, what? And I went and looked it up, and there it is. I was like, oh, boy.
Yeah, and if you ever read a story with him, he sounds just as bad as he looks. It's not good. And I know people say – well, it was the time period. But actually, it really wasn't, because they actually dropped the character because they got angry letters. And particularly, there were two youth groups that objected to the use of the character. So even back then, you know, people were looking at this character as, this is not good. And I think these youth groups, I can't remember the name of the organization, but they were actually an integrated youth group,
wow.
And obviously from up north. So they did drop the character around this time period, fortunately. So he has not been seen since. I'm not sure the year. I want to say by 44, maybe. I could be wrong. Okay. But and also in the same image, this one's much less obvious, but they have a Japanese villain who had the unfortunate name of Nippo. And, oof. You know, that's one of the actual reasons that – do you know about the Monster Society of Evil story?
Yes, that famous – why don't you explain it for people who don't know what it is?
It was the first really serialized ongoing storyline in comics, and it ran – I want to say like 24 issues. And it was a continuous story where basically all of Captain Marvel's villains formed the Monster Society of Evil. And it got reprinted once in either the late 80s or early 90s in this beautiful hardcover. And several times since then, because that hardcover now, if you want to get it in really good shape, it goes for a couple $100s because it's so rare. But they've announced several times over the last decade or so that they were going to collect it again, because it's a really good story overall. And it's, again, very significant for being kind of the first serialized story in comics. But one of the reasons it keeps getting canceled, people believe, you know, it doesn't get confirmed. Obviously, sales could be the factor. But one of the reasons it's believed it gets canceled is because there are some unfortunate racial stereotyping that goes on in that storyline. And so that is, you know, not unique to Captain Marvel, but kind of an unfortunate, you know, aspect of the history there.
Could, you know, run a page in the front that says, look, this is the context of the time and we're presenting it from that point of view. I mean, Warner Brothers did that when they released all their cartoons mm-hmm. on DVD, you know, where they were like, even some of the ones with unfortunate racial stereotypes, they had a little card that came up in the front that said, you know, we're not endorsing this, but this was a product of its time, and we feel it's, you know, responsible to sort of show these as what they looked like. That said, these treasuries edited the material all the time.
Yeah.
DC edited their stuff all the time. They constantly were adding blurbs at the end to make it more – to make it fit with a more modern thing or whatever. I mean, like all the – for something closer to home, like all the reprints of More Fun Comics number 73 feature Aquaman with green gloves, not yellow gloves, because that was the way the character looked at the time. So this would have been no effort at all to just wipe that character out, no pun intended. You know what I mean? To just remove him from the pinup, and that way it's not so offensive, because again, when you see it, you're just like, oh boy, you know, that is rough.
It's a shame, because it's otherwise a really lovely image of the whole cast. I mean, it looks great.
Yeah, you got some, and it's funny that it's Captain Marvel with his villains. It's like a family portrait, but he's with people that are trying to kill him. You know, there's Ibis and Savannah, and it's sort of funny where it's like, this is the family portrait. So we're all getting along for the moment.
It also includes Whitey, the character from the movie serial we talked about last year. He was in. Yeah, they brought him in briefly after that movie serial into the comics as a character. He didn't stick around that long, and he wasn't used too much, but he was made part of the comics as a result of that movie.
Very cool. Very cool. So, all right. Well, so the next story is from the Marvel Family, number 82. It is The Fantastic Freezing Furies by Bender, again, and Kurt Schaffenberger. When a new gold rush breaks out of the Yukon, the Marvel Family have to step in and help the prospectors when their town becomes buried in snow. Unfortunately, this is no accident. It's the work of the Ice King, a leader of a group of Arctic people who plan to take over the world by freezing it to death. This one is weird. I would say this is even weirder than the man with the multiple heads, simply because this Ice King guy, he's got this kind of like Jughead crown, and he's got a freezer gun, and he's got this long like, he's a really weird figure. I mean, the artwork by Kurt Schaffenberger is beautiful. It is fantastic. And Kurt Schaffenberger was one of those guys that when I was younger, I didn't like. I just didn't like, it's too cartoony. And I look at it now, and I'm like, this thing is perfect. Like, this is it is so beautifully put together. I love the detail, but it's also kind of cartoony, the way he can fit so much detail into these tiny panels. But man, this I had a hard time taking the Ice King seriously as a threat, because he's just so goofy looking.
I did like they really milked the cold thing, though, because they have him taking a bath in the cold water, and then when he gets out, he asks his like right hand assistant to just sprinkle him with little frosted snowflakes, because that's just something they do. But it's a really massive scale in this story, like the huge panels of the forest fire they're using to stop him, the images of him freezing the ocean around the world and destroying the cities. Doesn't happen. It's just he's showing what he's imagining is going to happen. But there's a lot going on here. There's the giant shot of Captain Marvel like flying the giant train through the sky with all the coal he's using to dump on the fire. It's just there's a lot going on here. And this story is – I enjoyed it just for the scale. It's based on this really goofy villain. And you're right. He looks absurd, just completely absurd. He's got the frozen mustache and hair.
He's got like these furry trunks.
Yeah, he's naked in all those people look the same. The whole group looks weird. But they also have that great shot of the woolly mammoths that they're all riding as part of their army. I love that image. And you're right. I also, as a kid, was not the biggest Schaffenberger fan, but have grown to love him over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
His Superboy series in the 80s, that was something as a kid I probably wouldn't have read. But now I find it really charming, and his art is a large part of that.
Yeah, it's really, really beautiful, beautiful stuff. Again, I love the sequence with the wolves, where the wolves attack Billy Batson is great. And I also like that this isn't something a lot of artists were not great at, is that like Captain Marvel Jr. and Mary Marvel are supposed to be younger than Captain Marvel, and they look younger. They're not just smaller versions of Captain Marvel. They actually – their bodies are different. You know, they have more youthful-looking kind of more teenager-y bodies, and that's a very, very distinctive thing. Again, a lot of artists are not great at that. This story is unique from the ones we've been talking about just because, as you mentioned, the scale. This is a worldwide threat. This guy wants to take over the Earth. It travels all around. As opposed to the other ones were just sort of local, this is like a big – especially when you're following the tawny one, which is almost like a sitcom. This has got almost like a Filmation cartoon kind of scale to it, of like with the giant laser cannon, and there's a giant crack in the they fly over the Gulf Stream and stuff like that. There's a there's a boiling pyramid, an atomic pile at the bottom of the ocean. So it has just like a bigger scale. And it's a nice change up from the other stories.
There's one moment too, whenever I read this story, and this isn't necessarily related to this story, but there's always this scene that reminds me of Crisis on Infinite Earths. Because there's a moment in there where the Atom is rescuing Billy and Mary and all these other kids that have been kidnapped by a group of bad guys. And one of the bad guys is Killer Frost. So she's frozen up the whole place, like everything. He's surrounded by ice. And all the kids are huddled together with Billy and Mary and all the others behind him, sort of tied up. It is just that scene where he's got them all tied up and their heads frozen. It just always reminds me of that moment of Crisis on Infinite Earths. I'm not sure. Beyond the ice connection, there's not much there, but it always brings it to mind. You had mentioned his art. One thing, since this is the first time we've encountered Mary, the three artists that probably drew her the most were Mark Swayze, her co-creator, and Jack Bender, Otto's brother, who was an artist for Fawcett, and Schaffenberger. And Schaffenberger's style was very different than the other two. But I think one of the reasons I've always really liked Mary is she's just always a very well-drawn, well-designed character. Her costume is great. I mean, obviously all the costumes are similar in design, but her version with the skirt always looks great. The way they draw her face, she's just a very pretty character. And her whole personality is wonderful. She's got this just sweet, innocent kind of facade, but she's always very tough, as we'll see later in her story. So Schaffenberger in particular, I like the way he draws Mary, even though it is, again, very different than the other two artists.
Yeah, it's a very, very nice story. And in the middle of the story is the pinup. It's the centerfold of the thing, which is just a shot of Shazam with Solomon, Hercules, Atlas, Zeus, Achilles, Mercury. And thanks to the Filmation live-action show, which I watched incessantly as a kid, I can always rattle off those names without having to look. You know, if somebody just asked me, what does Shazam stand for? I could just immediately do it. It's a nice pinup. I don't know. I couldn't find the credited artist. Do you have an idea who drew this?
I believe this is another Ochsner image. I think it's another one he filled in to kind of pad out the treasury a little, but it is great. It's beautiful.
Yeah, just him flying out at the camera with all the gods behind him. So it's very, very nice. So, and then the next story is another Shazam story, The Mistake of Father Time. It's from Marvel Family number 20 by Otto Bender and C.C. Beck. After Captain Marvel laments he was too late to save the life of a pilot who crashed his plane, Father Time himself steps in and turns back time, allowing Marvel to save the man. But Father Time doesn't just turn back the clock. He literally makes time go backwards, causing massive confusion to Earth's mightiest mortal. I loved this story. Oh, by the way, I should mention the art was also by Pete Costanza. I left him out. I loved this story because it is so much of a mind bender in that the story literally does go backwards. And the idea that like these comics were aimed at probably very small children, 7, 8, 9-year-olds, the idea that you thought kids could keep up with that, I think is a compliment to children that they could follow this. Cause I mean, they don't give you any indication for a little while that the things are literally going backwards and you have to sort of keep your mind straight that you're reading the story backwards. I love the conceit of this.
I did think when I was reading this that the artist and the writer, they had to put a lot more thought into this story and the layout of how it's progressed. This is not a simple thing. And the weird, of course, in keeping with Marvel Family Comics of the 40s, Father Time has no idea he's done this. He literally has just an hourglass he carries. He knocked over accidentally, and that is the basis of this entire story. Everything going backwards and Captain Marvel being able to save the pilot who he had seen die in the beginning of the story. But Father Time doesn't have a clue any of this is going on.
And I like that detail too, that it's got the idea of Captain Marvel being sad that he couldn't save somebody. Like that's a little bit of an adult idea. I mean, somebody dies in a Captain Marvel story. That's, you know, like, wow.
And the art in the panel, they show that plane crash. That's a little startling. They don't hold back in that. Do you see the crumpled plane and the body peeking out from underneath? It's a start, especially for that to be the opening panel to the story.
Yeah, it's great. I love how sort of fast and loose the Marvel Family comics could be of just that you could just have Father Time in your story. And that's a thing. You know, there's a guy who's like, and he's got the old gray beard and he's got like the flip flops on. You know what I mean? He looks kind of like your classic version of Father that you see at the end of the year on these New Year drawings. But I mean, it's like, I was really startled by this one. I thought this one was just terrific. It was really, really cool. I loved it.
Yeah, you mentioned the time period that other story was in. This was in 1948, so it was a few years earlier. But it's like you mentioned about Otto Bender. He not only was he this creative in these stories, But he went on to the Superman universe after Fawcett folded, and he was there creating Supergirl and Brainiac and Legion of Superheroes, your favorite, and all these other characters. So he went on to like another decade or so of amazing creativity. This is just the beginning of it. I mean, we're still only probably 7 or 8 years into his career as a writer, and he's going to go on still to do all that other stuff.
Pretty remarkable. I mean, he wrote Aquaman, too, for a brief time. There are some Aquaman stories from the mid-50s adventure run that he wrote. So, I mean, yeah, the guy was just a fountain for these ideas. So, yeah, I really thought this one was terrific. So, next up, there is a pinup, and it's a Sinister Faces thing where it's Captain Marvel looking like he's performing, like, a science experiment. He's got, like, a Bunsen burner and a little thing and all these, like... And the whole point is, how many sinister faces can you find leering at Captain Marvel in the picture? And there's all these, like, hidden faces. There's, like, a, you know, a bureau that looks like it has a face. And there's a machine. There's, like, some sort of, like, a radio transmitter. And then there's, like, a thing in the wood grain pattern has a face in it. This whole image is sort of just baffling to me because it's like, what? There's no context for it. You're like, why is Captain Marvel doing this? Why is there a spilled beaker on the floor where there's, like, a puddle of water or something? I'm guessing this is, like, an image from a story taken by itself. We don't know the rest of it. I mean, it's a cute, fun little bonus, but it's just kind of weird.
I have no idea where this came from. I love the look in his face, though, because he looks like he was taking this very seriously.
He is.
Really concentrating.
Yeah, really working on this. Yeah.
I did actually post this image to Twitter about a year and a half ago, kind of jokingly saying something like, oh, can you guess how many faces are hidden, kids? And I actually had quite a few people respond trying to guess the faces, and one or two people even showed me their homework where they were trying to draw them in. No one was able to get the full, I think it's 16, right?
Wow.
The most anyone was able to get was 12, which was pretty impressive because once people started responding, I sat down and tried to spot what I could, and I could only get to 9.
Right, yeah, I tapped out around 8, yeah. So, yeah, it's very, very, very strange. Next up is another pinup, and this one, what a beauty. You just talked about the simplicity, the beauty of the Mary Marvel costume, and this is a pinup of Mary Marvel, and it says, your friend Mary Marvel, and she's sitting on a mountaintop, and there's a lightning bolt, and she has that sort of classic 1940s actress face, you know? It's really a beautiful drawing.
Yeah, this one jumped out at me, and I'm very familiar with this image. This is the cover to WoW Comics 10. WoW Comics was the first title Mary got a solo feature in before she got her own title, Mary Marvel, but this is by her co-creator, Mark Swayze. And this is very in keeping with his style. And again, what I was saying earlier about how she was always sort of drawn by really talented artists, I think the way he drew her was just beautiful. And can you tell, looking at this, do you know what actress he based her character on?
You know, it looks like there's a lot of 40s actresses I can see, but I can't – I'm not – who are you thinking in particular?
It's Judy Garland.
All right. I can see that.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, if you look at the face, just the face, you could see the Darwin Cook. You know, I mean, it's like a Darwin Cook face. There.
You're right. I didn't make the connection, but now that you mentioned it, it's so obvious.
Yeah, really. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful image. Again, her costume is great. It's very, you know, I mean, I'm sure if you're a teenage boy, you know, you're like, hey, I like this Mary Marvel comic. So next up is the Mary Marvel solo story. It's called The Black Magician. It's from Marvel Family number 2 by Otto Binder and Jack Binder, talented family. A wizard who practices black magic teams up with a hunter to get revenge on Mary Marvel after she punched the hunter for shooting a deer at an animal preserve. This is another bonkers one where just weird shit happens because it can. I mean, you've got people that get animal heads put on them by the wizard and stuff like that. I don't know. I haven't read a lot of solo Mary Marvel stories. This one feels very much like even aimed at even younger children because it feels like a kind of like almost like a nursery rhyme, kind of the way that all these characters walk around with these animal heads and stuff like that. But I did like – my favorite part is Mary Marvel punching the hunter because they're in this animal preserve and it's meant to be kind of like a nature park. And this poor deer gets shot, which you see the deer get shot, which is – again, amazing, considering what ages they were aiming the story on. And you know, the hunter's like, I don't care, I want to shoot the deer. And Mary Marvel just socks him in the jaw, which is by far my favorite part of the story.
Oh, there are tons. Every story, she gets great moments like that, where you basically just see her beat the hell out of a couple guys. In fact, in her first appearance in Wiz Comics 18, she saves Billy and Freddy, who both been captured. And she wallops like three or four guys in just this beautiful series of panels where you see her just toss them around like rag dolls and such. If you've never seen that, go look up that story, because it's great just for those few panels. But
that sounds awesome, yeah.
This story actually kind of creeped me out a little, because when the scenes where the kids started having their faces replaced with animal heads, like the first girl it happens to, she looks like she's in tears, like bawling out of fear. And then the way he draws Mary, and she loses her memory, so she not only gets an owl head, but then she has no idea who she is. It was just really disturbing to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not scary, but just really creepy. And
yeah, right. The one girl that gets turned into the deer. She's like, what have you done to me? My head feels strange. And so every panel she's in, she's got tears shooting out of her eyes. So it's a little upsetting. Again, when you think about what age they were probably aiming this story at.
I had mentioned that when I was going through the different treasuries and trying to decide, each one had things I loved and things that kind of weighed against them. And the one thing that kind of weighed against this issue for me, it's not that I didn't like the story. I thought it was a decent story. But I didn't necessarily think it was the best Mary Marvel story. Mm-hmm. I think some of the other treasuries, when she gets her solo stories, I do think they're stronger than this one. So that was – and Mary Marvel is my favorite superheroine. I just love the character. And she does have a lot of great comics in the 40s. And again, this isn't bad. It's just not what I would have selected for a Mary Marvel story in here.
Right. Like I said, I haven't read too much Mary Marvel. And I was like, really? Is this what these stories were kind of like? And maybe, as you're saying, maybe they're not, you know, in this one. But yeah, presumably this was compiled by E. Nelson Bridwell, so I'm sure he had a certain amount of page counts that he had to be limited to, and so, you know, hard to know what order these went in. But yeah, I think this is a little bit of a weird choice for a Mary Marvel story, but at least we get to see her again in the previous story with the other Marvel family, so this is like not her only appearance in the book.
Now, so, she does hang out a lot with kids and stuff. That is right. Something she's more, so that's not unusual for her. It's just sort of the creepy vibe from the plan, that's all.
Yeah. So next up is Uncle Marvel's Rival by Otto Binder and C.C. Beck from Captain Marvel Adventures 53. Billy Batson's Uncle Ebenezer shows up unexpectedly asking for financial help from his nephew, whom he believes is wealthy thanks to his connection to Captain Marvel. When he learns that Billy's beloved Uncle Marvel is in charge of the organization that gives all the money to charity, he tries to get between Billy and Uncle Marvel and steal the money for himself. So yeah, this is the beginning of I should also mention the art is by Pete Costanza as well as Beck. It's fun. This is the first appearance of Uncle Marvel in the Treasury, a character that I think maybe for some people is like pushes the limits of your tolerance of the silliness of the Marvel universe. But I found this story very charming just because I love the idea that Billy, who of course is an orphan, has an Uncle Ebenezer who shows up out of nowhere and is basically like, hey, kid, I know you must be loaded. Help me out. I love that.
I admit that Dudley is my least favorite. I don't dislike the character. But of all the Marvel family characters, my least favorite, because his shtick does kind of get old pretty quickly.
Right.
And it just repeats in every story that he's basically pretending to have powers and then he doesn't. He's a lovable old guy that hangs out with them and kind of everyone pretends he's their uncle. But the whole idea of him having to change clothes while they're all saying Shazam and they magically transform, but he has to stay behind to get his outfit. And then he always comes up with some excuse why they have to rescue him or fly him and he can't use his power. It just kind of wears on me. But having said that, I did really like this story, and one of the big reasons is it actually ties up a huge loose end, because back in his first appearance, Billy's given to Uncle Ebenezer, who basically kicks him in the street and takes all his inheritance, and that's all he never gets his comeuppance or justice for all these years. So I was happy to see that finally they brought him back, and he got some appropriate punishment for what he did to poor Billy as a little kid.
Yeah, he's a real dick here. There's a panel in the story that I love because it's sort of like this is before this was the thing, but it's almost like the writer's hanging a lampshade on how weird all this is. And it's this great panel of Billy thinking to himself, and he goes, holy moly, it's true. Uncle Dudley or Uncle Marvel is not my true uncle, but my Uncle Ebenezer is. Yet I like my fake uncle, and I don't like my true uncle. What a crazy situation. Yeah, pretty much. That's pretty much how it works.
Yeah, when Dudley showed up originally in the comics, he did literally just pretend to be Mary's uncle. And they have all just went along with it. And that always did just seem a little odd to me. So I am kind of glad they specifically mentioned that. I shouldn't be too harsh on Dudley, though, because he did have one really great moment, which was when they were fighting Black Adam. And you probably know it, but Black Adam actually only had one appearance in the Golden Age, which blows my mind given what a huge character.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. He only appeared in Marvel Family 1. And then he was brought back in the 70s. And, of course, in the 2000s, you know, Jeff Johns,
yeah,
he exploded. I mean, he may be played by The Rock in a movie at some point, but he did have a moment of that issue. He was the one who tricked Black Adam into saying Shazam and getting transferred form back into a person, so they were able to stop him. So Dudley did have one really big moment that I always liked. So good for him.
Good for him. Again, and this is, you know, this Treasure is obviously meant to be a sampling of the character, and you got to get all the characters in. I mean, the only character that doesn't appear is Hoppy the Marvel Bunny, I'd say, of the big Marvel characters. I mean, there was the Hillbilly Marvels and the Fat Marvels and all that stuff, but there is no Hoppy here, but at least they get Uncle Marvel. And so and then the final story is the Trio of Terror. I couldn't find a writer's credit, but the art is by Jack Bender and CC Beck. It's from Marvel Family 21, and it's three brothers who run a failing circus try to convince the Marvel family to join their circus to bring in more money. When they are turned down, the brothers use a book of black magic to conjure monsters from the netherworld and use them as attractions. But the monsters have other plans, so it's up to the Marvel family to step in. Again, this was another one where it reminded me of the Father Time story of the Marvel family's, the Shazam comics' willingness to just go kind of Dada-esque and just weird stuff happens because it can. And these three monsters get called up from the netherworld, and one of them looks like Pan and another one has two heads. I mean, it's like, huh? Like what? Like all of a sudden we've got like the world of the hell, creatures from hell itself showing up in a Marvel family comic.
You probably will not be surprised to hear that this is written by Otto Bender again.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Of course. And these creatures, it's a good example how C.C. Beck in his art, he could draw these things that's this perfect blend of just incredibly goofy, but really disturbing at the same time.
Yeah, the guy with two heads is upsetting. And then the third guy, I should mention, he's kind of got like a cone head, and he has all these different eyes on it. He's got multiple eyes on his head. So they're really almost like
Lovecraft.
They are like Lovecraftian kind of monsters, again, for a children's story.
Yeah, this is... I always wonder how the heck Otto Bender was able to come up with this stuff. Because how do you even sit down and put, like, the Father Time story of this? That's who, I mean, not to beat a dead horse, but that's a lot of creativity to come up with that kind of stuff over and over and over.
It sure is, yeah.
And it's always made me sad because Otto Bender has become one of my favorite writers, both because of these stories and what he did for Superman. And he was actually a book author, too. He wrote under a pen name. It's kind of hard to pronounce. The spelling is weird, but I think it's pronounced Iando Bender. He wrote science fiction novels, and he actually – sometimes the pen name was just for him. Sometimes he wrote – him and Jack had a third brother named Earl, and sometimes Otto and Earl wrote those books together under that pen name. But he had a very prolific career as a writer, both in comics and novels, and he did it for like 30 years, amazingly creative. But he – the last few years of his life are really sad. And he first in the 60s, he lost all of his money because he invested in this publishing venture for a magazine, and it didn't go well. It went bankrupt. And he basically lost most of his savings. And he later on would reference that he was still writing basically because he had no choice. He needed the money.
Wow.
But even far worse than that is him and his wife had one child, a daughter, and she was killed when she was only 14. Basically, a car hit a curb and killed her. And it basically understandably devastated
his wife.
And they never recovered. Apparently, the wife had something of a nervous breakdown and just was never the same after that. And Otto took to drinking heavily, apparently, and ended up, after a few years, dying of a heart attack. And I just hate that a man who probably brought joy to literally tens of millions of children for over decades of time, and not that that's a unique story, but to have such a sad ending over the last few years. It just, I hate knowing that he had to go down such a dark road in his life.
Yeah, that's, I didn't know any of that. That's very tragic. Because, yeah, I mean, these Captain Marvel comics were massively popular. I mean, they were so popular, that's what led DC Comics to sue Fawcett and basically sue Captain Marvel out of existence because they perceived him as such a threat. I mean, you don't have to spend a lot of time on Mike's Amazing World or the Grand Comic Book Database or even an old price guide to see how many Superman knockoffs there were in the 40s. And yet DC never sued any of those creators for the most part. And why? I think because most of those characters weren't very popular.
Yeah.
And so DC wasn't threatened by them. But Captain Marvel was so hugely popular. He had a movie serial, again, which you and I talked about on Film and Water last year. And there was, think about, you just mentioned WoW comics. Like, how many different Captain Marvel comics there were on the stands at this time? There was Wiz Comics, there was Captain Marvel Jr., there was Captain Marvel Adventures, there was the Marvel Family, WoW Comics. I mean, there was a lot of titles. And apparently they just kept flying. And the only reason they stopped is because they got sued out of existence.
Yeah, they lasted really by the late 40s. Most companies had stopped publishing superheroes, including right. Timely. But Quality and Fawcett were the two that managed to stretch on, basically because they did such a great job and the characters were so popular. Fawcett finally folded, I think, about 53. And it wasn't just the lawsuit. The lawsuit obviously was a big factor, but their sales had started to decline. But still, that's an amazing run. That's like 13 years of being on top of the world. But they did start to decline, and they finally, not just their Captain Marvel, but some of the other titles they were publishing. Right. So they did decide to finally fold. And I don't know what the company, the greater company over just Fawcett Comics was, but I think it was DC finally came back in, was it 73, and started licensing him?
Right.
And then I don't think they finally bought the character sometime around 90 or 91. And I've always wondered, I don't know what made them, maybe it was Jerry Ordway's series or they just got tired of lost licensing, I don't know. But that's when they finally took full ownership of the character.
Hmm.
But fortunately, all these 40 stories are still, the stories themselves are public domain. So if you're interested in reading Captain Marvel stories, you could easily go on Digital Comics Museum or Comic Book Plus, and they're all there. Like every comic book they appeared in the 1940s and 50s is available legally to read online.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that they were public domain at this point. That's interesting. Wow.
Most qualities are too, like Plastic Man, Blackhawk. You can find all them as well.
Very cool. The last thing I want to mention about this story is it features, again, one of my favorite panels, and that it's kind of just Dada-esque in its own way. And it's the final panel after the monsters have been sent back to the netherworld by via some magic words. Zagos, Zarilli, Goosh, as opposed to, you know, Klaatu, Barada, Nikto, or something like that. But Captain Marvel is, or Billy Batson is reading the paper with Freddie and Mary, and it says later. And then Mary says, gosh, I'm glad it all turned out for the best after all. But let's hope nobody else ever else conjures up monsters from the netherworld. You and me both, Mary. I hope that doesn't happen. I don't know. I love these panels. This story, I thought it was a lot of fun. I also like the idea of the circus owners, the Dingling Brothers, as they're called.
Oh, God. Those guys, I like how they kept popping up, no matter what was going on, they kept popping up with a contract in their hand wanting the bats to sign off for their circus.
Yeah. I love the idea that a superhero could be used as a marketing tool to make money. That's kind of a novel idea for the 1940s. And the whole idea that there was like a Captain Marvel Foundation that Uncle Marvel ran and it was used to distribute money to kids. Like, what a great idea. Like, of course, like I could see a superhero saying, I don't think they ever explicitly did this in the stories, but like him selling himself almost like as an endorsement, but, you know, as like a pitch man, but using the money to help children. Like, that's a fun idea.
Yeah, that was a really nice touch. Again, Bender, he was really good at that stuff. And just little nice touching moments and kind of world building. You get the sense that they do have lives outside of what we see in the stories. And there's,
right.
You know, these projects they're working on. And it just kind of – it gives the characters a little more substance or depth than you would kind of get in a typical Golden Age story.
Absolutely. And on the inside back cover, we have a little bonus feature, Shazam on the Screen. And it's just a couple of panels from the Captain Marvel movie serial, because, of course, this is before the TV show. So right now they're just talking about the movie serial. And when I was a kid, I loved these features because, of course, the Captain Marvel movie serial wasn't available anywhere. Maybe they ran it on television or something, but I never saw it. So I was really like, wow, there was a Captain Marvel movie? Like, oh my God, that's so cool. And there's this great shot here, Tom, of Tom Tyler standing there in his Captain Marvel outfit and a couple of shots of him flying. But I ate this stuff up just because it was a portal into a world I never got to see.
I was thinking about that because this is, you know, so far pre-internet, every kid picking this up, this was their first time learning that. And that, I figured that did have to blow their minds because I honestly didn't own this. I came in after Treasuries had gone out by just a few years in comics. So by the time I owned this Treasury, I'd known for years because it was in the 2000s. But I was thinking how many kids were learning history that they would learn no other way at the time, unless maybe an issue of Amazing World of DC Comics or something. This taught, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of kids about movies. They may not even know what movie serials were from any other source.
Yeah. Really, really cool. And so, and then the final bonus feature is the back cover, which is the tabletop diorama. And I, strangely enough, the diorama is an image of Billy standing there with his arms akimbo, and then there's a similar shot of Captain Marvel. That's actually very similar. It might even be the exact same image from the previous Shazam Treasury, in terms of the pose. So I guess they figured that, you know, hey, we just reuse it, why not? But I don't think I had a chance to ask you the last time you were on because we talked about A Famous First Edition. Did you ever – you said that you came – you know, you came to comics after the treasures are gone, but did you or have you or your children ever bothered to try and make one of these dioramas?
No, but I did wonder. It's amazing I even see any copies of these still around because there's so much encouragement for kids to just rip apart these comics. Right. Especially Shazam. There's like 7 or 8 different games in here encouraging kids to get the scissors and start cutting these issues up. But I got to think there probably were a lot of kids having fun with this because this is very charming. A lot of these games are. They're just charming.
Yeah. They're cute. And said this one's probably among some of the other dioramas. This one's probably slightly easier in that the line work is like kind of crisp and clean, a little easier to follow as opposed to saying like a Neil Adams Batman or something like that. So, but yeah, I didn't really do too many of these. I just lacked the sort of dexterity to sit there and cut all these things out, especially with the crude cutting implements I would have had access to at this age. So anyway, that is basically that's the Treasury. It's a limited collector's edition. I mean, I think, as a keepsake, as a way for DC to introduce the character to kids, because, I mean, of course, this character had been off the stands for almost 20 years at this point. I think this is a really solid collection. I think it's one of their best in terms of the breadth of stories. I mean, of course, they're all by Otto Binder, but, I mean, you've got different characters. You've got some that are more like low-key, like the Talkie Tawny one, and then you've got the one with the Ice King, which is much more grand fantasy. I think this is a really solid collection of Shazam stories.
Yeah, and I like it because it's entirely made up of Golden Age stories and how many treasuries back in the 70s were doing that.
Right.
But I do think they held up well, and I think kids in the 70s probably had a lot of enjoyment from this. I think a lot of these stories were just as entertaining then as they probably were back in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, it's a really, really good book, and it topped off by that gorgeous cover, which we talked about, by Bob Oxner. So, but before we sign off, I do need to ask you, like, what are your thoughts on the Shazam movie? I haven't seen it. You haven't seen it yet, but we've seen the trailers. Like, what are you looking forward to it?
I am. My feelings have been kind of mixed over time, and they've gotten better as it's gone along. But I guess a year ago, I wasn't in a particularly good place with DC films generally. But I have enjoyed the last couple. I thought Wonder Woman was good. I thought Aquaman was a heck of a lot of fun, and I really liked it. So I've gotten more optimistic about them. And the one thing that kind of keeps me a little bottled up on this one, though, is the new 52 Shazam series that Geoff Johns did. I wasn't the biggest fan of it. I didn't kind of like the direction they took the character and some of the changes they made. I mean, if you loved it, great, you know. But for me, whenever I see the movie, there's so much they took from that, both in the look of the characters and sort of the storyline, that it does – I do feel a bit of a disconnect. It's probably like having being an Aquaman fan for 80 years and having them physically sort of match your least favorite run of the character,
right?
So if you can imagine such a thing. But that doesn't mean I'm not hoping to enjoy it or looking forward to it at all. It just means I guess I do feel a little like this isn't necessarily – like, if I could make a Captain Marvel or Shazam film, this isn't the one I would make. That doesn't mean it may not be a lot of fun. I really like the cast. They seem super enthusiastic and very likable whenever I hear. The director seems like a good guy. I do think the trailers definitely showed potential. So I'm looking forward to it. But there's just some aspects to it that give me a little pause. And I guess it's, in a weird way, it's kind of a good place to be. Because if I end up seeing it and liking it, it blows me away. It's going to be even better. But if I end up kind of not liking it, there's kind of enough of a disconnect there that I'm not necessarily going to associate it with sort of my history of the character in Shazam and Captain Marvel. So it's probably – I'm not trying to be less enthusiastic about it or bring people down or looking forward to it. I'm just kind of saying there are a few aspects to it. It went a direction I wouldn't have picked if it was up to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I can see that. When I first saw the first trailer, I actually thought it looked kind of cheap. I thought it looked kind of like a cheap movie. It just didn't. And I don't need, you know, I don't need a giant blue beam to come down out of space and destroy everything because we have enough of that. But I don't know. There was something about it. I just thought it just looked kind of chintzy or whatever. But I'm still going to see it because it's a Shazam movie. And I've always liked this character. And I'm glad that he's finally getting a movie. And I hope they do right by it. I am heartened by the fact that they are not so beholden to making this one big one big universe. I mean, they're loosely connected. We had heard the rumors that Henry Cavill was supposed to do a cameo in the movie as Superman, but I guess that didn't work out. But nevertheless, that's an indication that, yeah, this does exist in the larger DC universe, and that in this universe, there is an Aquaman. In the latest trailer, there's even a nod to Aquaman. So, I mean, it's all kind of big, but I also like the idea that they're a little more separate. They're like, okay, we can have a Shazam movie over here and a Wonder Woman movie over here and an Aquaman movie. And, yeah, they all exist in the same universe, but it's not the Marvel. It's not the MCU because they've got that down to perfection in terms of how overlapping all that is. So I like the idea of maybe doing something a little different. And I will say I have no idea whether they're going to do this. I would love it if they hint at some of the other concepts, maybe for another movie. I mean, you don't have to go overboard. But like kind of how I love the Shazam Power of Hope treasury that, again, Alex Ross did, that there's one panel featuring Talkie Tawny. I hope there's like a little bit of a nod to that. That would be fun if they could find a way to work Mary Marvel and Captain Marvel Jr. into it or something like that. So, yeah, I'm kind of going into it with like, okay, I think it looks pretty good. I'm not overwhelmed by it. But as you said, if it's great, then that'll blow me away and that'll be fantastic.
I do agree with you about keeping them separate, but in the shared universe, but the way the approach they're taking now allows for a lot more variety and tone to these films.
Yep.
And I think that serves these characters a lot better than having to kind of all have the same look and feel to them. So that gives me hope, not just for this one, but for all the kind of future DC movies. And I kind of get a kick after all these years of, you know, Superman and Batman, and Superman's my favorite character, so it's not a knock to him at all. But I do kind of like the idea that to the general public now, Wonder Woman and Aquaman are like the biggest DC characters, and which blows my mind.
Isn't that amazing?
And potentially Shazam may join them. That's just, you know, that's crazy.
Yeah, I definitely would not want to see Shazam in the Batman v Superman universe. Like, I don't want to see him in that world. I'd be happy with him being in this kind of like sitcom-y sort of premise and things like that. So, yeah, it'll be amazing, and I hope we can see the movie. And I'll maybe at some point on the network, we'll report back and find out and talk about what we thought of it. So, while we sign off here, Michael, thank you so much for stopping by again. Of course, you were on Film and Water just a couple of days ago talking about another Fawcett character, but now we're here talking about the Shazam Treasury. Where can people find them on the internet?
A couple places. One is the podcast Comics in the Golden Age. We have a Twitter account at Comics in the GA and a Facebook account, Comics in the Golden Age 2. Over the last year, we haven't done that many episodes. Our personal life has kind of kept us rather busy, so it's been very sporadic, but it hasn't gone away. It's still there. I also have the Kirby Cast myself, which is devoted to Jack Kirby, another podcast, and that is on Twitter at the Kirby Cast. That's another one that's been very sporadic in the last year, but it hasn't gone away either. Again, there's a lot going on. There's also, I'm one of the writers on the Legion of Super Bloggers. I tend to cover the animated series and the related cartoon. Occasionally dabble in other stuff as well, but those are the two I tend to focus on. And also, if you're a fan of the Golden Age screen actress Myrna Loy, I actually run a Twitter account devoted to her as well, at Myrna Loy Love. So I know it's kind of random in comparison to the other places, but I'm just a big fan of that actress. So if you like her, yeah, exactly. Who could not love Myrna Loy? Just like Mary Marvel, who could not love either one of those people? So
fair enough.
At Myrna Loy Love on Twitter.
All right, very cool. Again, thank you so much for stopping by. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And I want you to sit tight. We're going to play some podcast promos. When I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
The world's strongest hero.
The warrior from a hidden island.
The master of super speed.
The wielder of the weapon from beyond the stars.
The champion of the seven seas.
They are the only ones standing before a world beyond the brink of collapse. Their mission? Abolish war and crime. Eliminate poverty and hunger. Clean the environment. Cure disease. Even stop death itself. They promise within a year to make the world a utopia, no matter how many lines they might need to cross.
Coming soon to the Pulp to Pixel Network, The Squadron Supreme Cast, an exploration of Mark Gruenwald's epic 1985 Squadron Supreme miniseries. A look at the heroes, the villains, the fine lines separating them, and how this miniseries continues to play an influence in mainstream superhero comics.
It was 1938. The country continues its slow recovery from the Great Depression, while war clouds loom throughout Asia and German aggression builds in Europe. Americans seek comfort and distraction. It was a time when the most popular form of entertainment was radio, but a new form had been growing steadily and was set to explode. It was to become the golden age of the American comic book.
My name is Chris.
And my name is Mike. Please join us as we explore comics in the Golden Age between 1938 and 1955. All genres will be discussed, from superheroes to crime, horror, science fiction, humor, and Western.
So join us for the Comics in the Golden Age podcast, available through iTunes and Stitcher, and visit us on Facebook or at comicsinthegoldenage.com.
And we're back with listener feedback for episode 33, which was The Defenders with Dallin Bumgarten. And we're going to go right to comments from the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And the first comment on that episode is from Edo Bosnar, who says, "First, I have to say that what Dallin said near the end of the show bears repeating, i.e. that Rob is doing God's work with this comics podcasting. Indeed he is, and so is every other comics podcaster. My hat's off to you all. Otherwise, it's nice to hear a Marvel Treasury getting a little love, as it seems to me, without going back and counting, that the DC books get more coverage, and it's even nicer to see my favorite non-team, the Defenders, getting covered." I went back and I did the count inspired by your comment, and I saw that the breakdown is, so far we've done 20 DC Treasuries, 12 Marvels, and one other company. We do lean a little heavier on the DC. That is really mostly driven by the guests. I kind of tend to ask the guests what book they want to cover, and so more people just seem to pick the DCs, and of course for the next couple of shows that we're going to be doing more DCs, so the balance is even going to be even more out of whack, but I promise we're going to get to a couple of really good Marvels soon. I love the Marvel Treasury just as much as the DC, so I'm not trying to play favorites here. So anyway, thank you for the comment. Wardhill Terry says, "Okay, Rob, I did a little research, and Mike's amazing world, praise be his sight. Here's the breakdown. DC published 51 Treasuries. Of course, of those, 23 did not have Superman or Batman on the cover. 5 others did, but as part of a larger group, and those did not include their logo. Marvel published 30 Treasuries. Of those, 15 featured Spider-Man or Hulk on the cover. So Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, and Hulk accounted for half of each company's Treasury comics." Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, you know, those four were the big characters of those companies, so it makes sense. It is kind of a shame that they couldn't branch out a little more, but it's just, you know, they realize that if they're going to move a Treasury, it would probably help to have one of those four characters on it. So thank you, Wardhill. Gothos Mansion says, "I enjoyed the show, as always. As for why the Defenders got a Treasury, I figured it was due to the Hulk status as a TV star. This was the second Marvel Treasury I got, and I'm sure the Hulk's prominence on the cover led the 6 or 7-year-old Gothos Mansion to ask for it. By releasing the Defenders, Marvel could release a Hulk Treasury without trying to coordinate the contents with what would soon be reprinted in Marvel Superheroes. I figured the reason so many of the Spider-Man Treasuries were from Marvel Team-Up is because MTU issues weren't reprinted every month, and Amazing Spider-Man was reprinted every month in Marvel Tales." That's a good theory. On the cover, I do like it, but I agree with Dallin that Gil Kane isn't my favorite Hulk artist. Kane's work is full of fluidity and movement, and I always saw Hulk as a fairly lumbering character. Plus, Kane always drew the Hulk with such a huge ass. Go back and check Kane's Tales to Astonish issues, and Hulk's butt seems to take over half his body. Kane is one of my favorite Spider-Man artists. As for the Treasury itself, the origin was a good story to include just to show how an odd assortment of characters got together. As a kid, the Valkyrie story was my least favorite due to the fact that I was in my all-girls-but-mom-have-cooties period and Valkyrie's man-hating speech. Glad Englehart toned that down from Valkyrie's first two appearances, which I hadn't read when I first got the Treasury. My favorite story then, as now, was the two-part Len Wein Squadron Sinister story. Wein was one of those rare talents that just seemed to get every character that he wrote. I recently bought his entire Defenders run just because I love his Hulk run so much. Wayne stated several times that Batman was his favorite character, so I wonder if he included Nighthawk in the Defenders just so we'd have a Batman clone to write. Again, it's another interesting theory. That makes a lot of sense. And by the way, regarding Gil Kane's Hulk, I just did a Find Your Joy all about the Hulk paperback from Pocket Books, which features Gil Kane drawing Hulk, and I have to say how much I love Gil Kane. Yes, I agree. His Hulk is a lumbering kind of character, and Gil Kane is known for the solidity, but that's what I like about it. I do agree. Hulk's butt is incredibly huge when drawn by Gil Kane, but I don't know what that says about me. Liz Ann Oswald says, impressive podcast. Most impressive. Done that in Darth Vader voice. I always liked the Defenders, Nighthawk being my favorite, Valkyrie being my second. I'll just say cool podcast, and it was awesome seeing the Defenders in a treasury. Thank you, Lizanne. And then finally, Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcast Network says, Bill Everett was a four-letter word for willfully misinterpreting what an inker is supposed to do and being a lousy inker in general. Either Andrew only provided breakdowns that Everett was venting against, or he didn't faithfully recreate every line. Andrew was a much better artist than this chicken scratch, which looks more like Everett besides. My contemporaneous exposure to this team is almost exclusively the New Defenders, which had its merits, but I always struggled with Don Perlin's art. I still want to dig into this run in a more substantial way, which is not something I can say for many Marvel team books these days. Yeah, I mean, I hope we didn't spend too much time ragging on Bill Everett for that inking job. It is a weird story, though, that like he was sort of like purposely sabotage an artist just because he put a lot of lines in it. It's a weird. It is a very weird combo, seeing Ross Andrew and Bill Everett. I didn't see that too much. So everybody, that's all the comments from the Fire and Water Podcast website. So thank you so much for everybody. And then finally, I have to thank everybody on Twitter who retweeted the show. Every episode that gets retweeted helps you get the show noticed. So big thanks to 108th Sage, Rolled Spine, Oswald Liz, Lord Zed Lives, Storm Tracer 2162, Dark Longbox, Supermates Pod, Scott Slangward, Classic JLA, Factory Mirror, It's Plastic Man, Maxa Romero, Static Healing, Mick Jameson 1, Dan Eaker, Dr. Ange 70, Wilmart 06, Griffith Charles, Ryan Daly 01, Tude Mackers, Lee Asif, Sean 42AZ, Zoom Yukinuri, Justice Trek, and Comics in the Golden Age. And of course, that's Michael Lane, who was just on this episode talking about the Shazam treasury. So big thanks to him for stopping by to talk about Shazam on the debut of his movie. Very, very exciting stuff for Shazam fans. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I love talking to Michael. That's going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until the next episode, go big or go home.
So ends another adventure with the mighty Marvel. You won't want to miss the next exciting adventure with star reporter Billy Batson, his sister Mary, their friend Freddie Freeman, lovable Uncle Dudley, and that amazing talking tiger, Mr. Tonic.